All right. Well, welcome again. I'm going to be talking this morning, and we're going to be talking a little bit together about what is codependence. And it's a big question. So again, my name's Rick, and I'm a grateful recovery member of anything with 12 steps attached. So. And underneath all of that is this compulsive, insidious disorder that we call codependence. And underneath all those other things, the codependence is trauma. And I didn't realize that. I spent 14 years working in another program that served me really well. I got clean and sober. I learned how to go to meetings. I learned how to have a sponsor. I learned how to do all important things in that program. But after 14 years of being clean and sober, one day I started having all kinds of weird feelings come up. I started having some anxiety, I even had a panic attack, and I pulled over on the way home from my home meeting up in Everett, and my heart was racing, and I was getting dizzy. I thought I was having a heart attack. I thought, this is the big one, Mama. I'm coming home, you know. And it was an awful feeling. I called the AA car, and they came and drove right by me. And I remember going, what? So here I think I'm dying, all right? And so I call him back and say, you just rolled right by me. And then they turned around and drove right by me a second time. So I was not having a good day. And then they finally came and they checked me out. And I called a friend from my home group and he came and stood with me. And they did all my blood pressure and all. And they said, you're okay. I said, no, I'm not. This is not okay. I know okay. And this is not. They said, well, can you drive home? I said, well, I'll try. And I called my doctor on the way home. He said, well, you know, you might want to get to the hospital. I said, I'll try. And it started happening again. So I pulled over, and my friend drove me home. And then it started driving me home, and it started happening a third time. I said, you need to get to the hospital. So I spent 6 or 8 hours in the hospital, having them run all these tests. And that happened over the next 3 weeks, happened twice again, where the aid cars had to come and take me away. And they checked me out, and they said again, well, Rick, there's really nothing wrong with you. See, they didn't have a diagnosis for codependence. They were looking for a heart attack or a stroke or something like that. But and the closest that I got was one of the big, tall captain firemen came walking in. He said, tell me about your life. And I told him about my life a little bit, and he said, you're having a full-body panic attack. And that was the first experience I'd ever had with that. Well, those kept going on, and the depression set in, anxiety set in, and I thought I was losing my mind. So I saw a therapist, and she said, gee, you know, I'm not sure. I think you got a 17-year-old running your life. I said, I don't know what that means. And I called a preacher friend of mine, and he said, I think you need to get saved. And I said, well, that's stupid. And nobody knew what to do with me, and that was a really scary point because I wasn't drinking, I wasn't using drugs, you know. My wife wasn't beating me, and I wasn't beating her, you know. There wasn't anything happening in my life that was really manifesting the issue. So I finally went to another therapist in Bellevue, and she said, "You know, Rick, codependence is not in the DSM, their diagnostic manual." She said, "But it will kill you." And I really think you're suffering from codependence. And that just resonated. Because I had always thought that codependence was a proverbial spouse calling in for the drunken husband, you know. Or that people are just kind of annoying, just do too much all the time, you know, super nice. That's what my image was as a codependent. I had no idea. And so I got worse. Ended up going to a trauma specialist in West Seattle. Actually, it was Donna. And she said, you need to get the treatment. So I went, I was on a plane the next day down to Arizona, checked into the Meadows, and I said, you know, I think I'm going crazy. And they said, no, you're not going crazy. You're just traumatized. I said, what does that mean? I said, well, and then they started explaining it to me. But by the time I got there, I had regressed down to a 7-year-old. I was, in my intake, I was actually crying and talking like a 7-year-old. Are they going to be nice to me here? Do I get to have friends? And I looked at my wife like she was my mother and said, will you come visit me? And the nurse said, I'm going to talk to him like a 7-year-old. So we started talking. And she finally talked me into staying because I was there just to check it out. That's control, right? I mean, I just flew 1,100 miles, drove to this treatment center. I'm just here for information. That's it. It was so funny. They looked at me and winked and said, yeah, right. So anyway, I learned there some things about codependence that I want to share with you this morning. And the first thing is, if I can get this to work, I'm usually a whiteboard kind of guy. So now if I aim this at you, don't duck. I'm just seeing if, oh, here we go. Maybe I got turned around the wrong way. What is codependence? So let's just look at a few definitions, first of all. This is from our welcome statement. Codependence is the most deeply rooted compulsive behavior born out of our sometimes moderately, sometimes extremely dysfunctional family systems, which means that codependence can happen on a continuum. Not everybody has to go crazy and go to treatment. But everybody has that. Some people just have that silent misery. They know something's wrong, and they don't know what. And everybody around them knows something's a little wrong, but they don't know what. Especially if you're not drinking and using. Another definition would be, how are we doing here? Okay, codependence is a disease. This is from our blue book. And this one just struck me, because this is how I felt. Codependence is a disease that deteriorates our souls. It is debilitating, and if left untreated, causes us to become more destructive to ourselves and others. I read that when I was in treatment, and I just began to weep because I knew something was wrong with my soul. I knew the pain. I knew that it was like a sharp razor was scratching against my soul. And how do you describe that to a doctor? You know, how do you describe that to anybody? But I knew that I was deteriorating. So this thing we call codependence is a very insidious, very subtle killer, is what it is. Okay. Charles Whitfield wrote a book called Codependence, the Human Condition. It's a very good book. And in that book, he says, I believe that codependents are also frustrated mystics. He was talking about alcoholics. But he says, I think codependents are also frustrated mystics. Rather than being simply an escape from reality, codependence is also a search. So, you know, I think we all who are admitted codependents are pretty spiritually sensitive people. And we get stimuli all over the world, and we know something's not right with life. So we have a search. We have a hunger. We have a hunger for connection. And unfortunately, we tend to do that on a horizontal level only and make other people our higher power or try to be other people's higher power to try to resolve that spiritual, that need. And it creates more chaos than anything else. Okay. I think I'm going the wrong way. So this is just a summary we just talked about. So it's rooted in family trauma. It deteriorates our soul. It's a search for spiritual and mystical connection, but this is a very important point. It's a spiritual block, meaning it's impossible for me to have an authentic spiritual awakening, to have an authentic spiritual life, while I'm busy making you my higher power, or while I'm busy trying to be your higher power. So this has severe implications, especially for chemically dependent people who depend on an authentic spiritual awakening to stay clean and sober and thus stay alive. And I'm convinced that that's one of the reasons relapse rates are so high, because you can get clean and sober like I was, but if you're not dealing with the codependency, you're not able to have an authentic spiritual awakening that's going to allow you to live a life that works. So this is really just big. Okay, so codependence, generally speaking, is an adult response to childhood trauma and the underlying trigger for addiction. That's the best definition. I had pretty much devoted my life the last 3 years to studying codependence and the link between trauma, codependence, and addiction. And that's one of the things I want to share with you this morning. I'm going to do that from the whiteboard. Can everybody? I know it might be kind of hard to see back there, so let me know if it's too hard. I don't know what I'll do. Okay, one of the things I've learned about codependence is that addiction is a symptom, and Donna will be talking about this later this morning some more, but we, when we talk about recovery, we automatically typically think you know, drugs and alcohol. Oh, okay, you're in recovery. Oh, okay, you're a drunk, or you're a drug addict, or, you know, you have some other chemical dependency issue. And what I've learned is that addiction is a symptom. And that's pretty much what we treat as symptoms in our culture. Underneath all that, symptoms is just trauma that I discovered that I was carrying around. And I had been carrying it around for decades, right? And I had been denying it for decades. But my body said, and your body never lies to you. And my body said, okay, if you don't want to get the message, I'll give it to you, okay? I'll start telling you something's wrong until you get the attention. And when I say trauma, I'm talking about primarily unresolved childhood trauma. So when you hear me say trauma, what is it you think about? Anybody? What's that? Car crash? Yeah, right. So hospitals have a trauma center, right? And when you're in a trauma center, what's happening? I mean, is it kind of a calm, relaxed place to hang out, read a book? No, it's an emergency. The lights are flashing and people are coming in and the doctors are pumping people's hearts. And it's something we got to deal with. Somebody's either had a heart attack or there's been an accident or they've been shot or stabbed. And if you don't deal with it immediately, we're going to die, right? Well, unfortunately, in our materialistic culture, we recognize that as trauma. But we don't recognize psychological or spiritual trauma as being urgent. In fact, we oftentimes tell people, oh, get over it. Buck up. What's your problem? So but when I'm speaking of trauma today, I'm talking about unmet needs. That's an important point. Every child has needs to develop, right? They have to have food, shelter, clothing, but they also have to have and absolutely have to have affirmation, nurture, and loving guidance. They have to have, I bet that sounded good on the tape. People will be listening to that in a couple weeks and go, what the heck was that? That was water. It was only water. It's not vodka when I'm talking about unmet needs. Yeah. So I'm talking about needs for affirmation, nurture, and guidance. And to the degree that we don't get that as children, we suffer trauma. And it's real trauma. I mean, it's not something to mess with. So, and it happens on a continuum. You know, there are no perfect parents, but there are some evil parents. And so somewhere between 1 and 10, there's this continuum happening. And so to the degree you don't get your needs for affirmation, excuse my writing, nurture, and loving guidance, all under the umbrella of loving unconditional love, you suffer trauma. Now, we call needs needs for this one reason. They don't go away. If a little boy or a little girl comes to their mom and says, Mommy, I'm hungry. And the mom says, gee, you know, Johnny, we had to pay the rent this week. So we don't have any food. So can you just not be hungry? You know, you can see an eight-year-old going, oh, yeah, I get it. Yeah, no problem. Yeah, that doesn't happen, right? The kid, or especially an infant. An infant will just keep crying till you feed it. Well, we have these needs, too, in our development for affirmation, nurture, and guidance. And if they don't get met, they continue to stay there. They get worse, just like the hunger. That's what a codependent feels, is the hunger. This hunger for affirmation, nurture, and guidance, for unconditional love. And if that need doesn't get met, it just sticks with us. But a kid that's not getting that affirmation, nurture, and guidance, what do you think they begin to think of themselves? Yeah. I'm trying to do two things at once. I'm trying to do the whiteboard and here, so bear with me a moment. Well, that's what happens. Every root cause. So we talked about that. There's the root cause. We need affirmation. The only way a child knows who they are is how they experience the primary caregiver. A child can't just wake up one day at 4 years old and say, no, I'm pretty good. I'm good. You know, I can nurture myself. I can affirm myself. I can even give myself some good guidance. I'm figuring out what college to go to at 4 years old. Kids don't think that way. So if they're not getting affirmation, nurture, and guidance, they begin to develop an opinion of themselves. The parent's primary task is to teach a child who they are in relationships to God, themselves, and others. So what happens is they begin to think you're just right. The child thinks I'm worthless. If the people that are supposed to love me the most aren't loving me, what does that say about me? I'm worthless. So by the time you're 4 to 6 years old and that's happening, that's a wound. And trauma is just a Greek word for wound, traumata. It means that you're suffering a wound in your soul. And we all know what it feels like. But that child begins to think I'm worthless. I deserve to be treated this way. I deserve to be abandoned. But he or she also thinks, if I don't connect, I'm going to die. Now, they don't say those words at 4 to 6 years old. But what I did when I was that age, I came home from school in first grade, and I had a little yellow 45 record that I went into my bedroom with, had a phonograph. And I was already feeling so isolated in my own family that I would go home. I'd walk all that way home because it was a long way for a kid. So I was already lonely. And I would go in and I would play Tex Ritter, Hillbilly Heaven. I dreamed I was there. And I would just play it. Okay, it was a human voice. And I would just play it over and over and over and over again because I had this ache in my heart. If I don't connect, I'm lonely. Why am I lonely? So I was already feeling like the lonely blue-eyed guy, you know? No one knows what it's like. Remember that song? So, worthless, I deserve to be treated this way. I deserve to be abandoned, neglected, and abused. And if I don't connect, I'm going to die. Okay. So as that child grows, and assuming they get enough food, shelter, and clothing, by the time they're 12 to 14 years old, they're learning to adapt to that wound. They're learning to say, you know what? I got to survive this somehow. What am I going to do? So I'm going to advance this a little bit. So that's, look at that picture. That's what trauma feels like. People supposed to love you the most aren't. So by the time you're a teenager, you're into what they call an adapted state. You're learning to survive, and adapting is all about survival. I have got to survive this sense of worthlessness. I have to survive this sense of I deserve to be treated this way. I have to find some way to connect with people. And for me, when I was 14 years old, I was feeling this achy loneliness, all the stuff that goes on with that trauma, and somebody came up to me and said, would you like to drink some of this? And I said, why, yes, I would. And they said, would you like to smoke some of this? And I said, yes, I would. And they said, would you like to do them together? I said, absolutely. Because I quit feeling the pain, right? And then I discovered rock and roll, and then I discovered sex. So by the time I was 15, I had sex, drugs, and rock and roll going. I'd died and gone to heaven, I thought. But it quit working. But this is usually where a child starts acting out, and as a rebellious kid or a super kid, you know, straight A's, cheerleader or a football star comes home on that. Wally Beaver is a super kid. You ever watch that program? Wally Beaver is a super kid. Alcohol and other drugs, religiosity as opposed to authentic spirituality, promiscuity, and eating disorders are very common at this point. Okay, so this is all about survival. So that kid is surviving, but these needs, remember, needs, we call them needs, why? Because they don't go away, right? So by the time this kid is 21 plus, he or she looks like an adult outside, but inside, they're a child still. Because they haven't been able to develop. They haven't had the affirmation, nurture, guidance. They haven't had the love they needed. It sounds like a Hallmark card. And I say this to some people, and they go, oh, come on, Rick. You know that. No, really. Love's important. Nurture is important. Affirmation is important. These are all things that we needed for our development. So this kid is now an adult, but he's an adult, he or she's an adult child at this age. And those needs have gone unmet. So they go out into the adult world now, and they start looking to get those needs met. But what they're looking for is a parental blessing. They're looking for somebody to parent them. It'd be like if I went to Spokane where I grew up at 57 years old and drove up to the house and got myself a good little boy crew cut and little strappy t-shirt and rolled up jeans. And I got my suitcases and I went to the front door and I said, bang, 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 I'm back. And I said, you know, you guys really blew it. I've been doing some reading. I was even in treatment because of you. But I'm here to give you a second chance. So I'm going to move in, and I'm going to give you another 18-year shot. And I hope you do better this time. What do you think they would do? Huh? Yeah. They'd probably say, we're convinced, Gary, he was crazy. Slam the door, call the police, do something. And that would be, it's absurd, right? But that's what we do as codependents. We go out into adulthood, and we start walking around saying, will you love me? Will you be my parent? Will you give me unconditional positive regard 24/7? Will you be there for me all the time? Will you give me what I didn't get growing up? So it's maladaptive. Will you be with me? Will you parent me? Will you be my higher power, basically? Or we become dominating as well as needy or even violent. As you'll hear in my presentation this afternoon about love addiction and love avoidance, this is really part one of two pieces. It can get violent. There's nothing worse than the scorn of a codependent that's not getting their needs met, right? Because they're driving needs. Elizabeth will tell you, my wife. Okay, I'm going to put that back. So they're going out into the world to get these needs met, and they're really asking somebody to parent them or be their higher power. And guess what happens? It doesn't happen, right? That's a parental relationship. You had one set of parents, and that's all you get. And to the degree they do it, that's it. And you may get authority figures or extended family there that can help. But ultimately, it's the deal's done. You know, you're kind of there. And so, but you go out into the adult world, primary romantic relationships or authority figures at work or in the church or someplace, and you're always in this one down position. You're always trying to get somebody to give you what you didn't get. You're always trying to get your needs met in relationships, and it's driving you. And what happens is you have this conflict, because adult relationships are defined by mutuality. I'm really not getting good at this, am I? Okay, I'm going the wrong way. I might just have to skip this. Okay, back up one. Okay, adult relationships are defined by mutuality. They're respectful, they're genuine, and they're free choice. If you really want to know human bondage, get into a relationship with a good, flaming, untreated codependent, right? Because you're no longer your own. Mutual, respectful, genuine, free choice. They don't know how to do that. So what happens is you get a lot of pain. I remember in the midst of our disease, at a point in my marriage, Elizabeth asked me, how do you feel about our relationship? What do you really feel? And I said, pain. Well, I didn't go over very well. And I said, but I feel pain and fear. And she had to agree. That's pretty much what she feels most of the time, too, is pain and fear. That was driving our relationship, when jealousy and anger and rage and all the other things were driving it. So we knew something was wrong, but that's what's driving relationships. And the reason is because a codependent goes out, and this one insane thing. Now remember, the original trauma was bad enough, right? That was bad enough to get you here. Maybe in some survival behaviors. So you're already hurting. This is bad enough. But now, the adult child is going out, and they're replicating. You would think, now let me just ask you this. You've been abused, neglected, and abandoned all your life. You're out in the adult world now. You would think, boy, that was enough of that. I'm not going to go back into relationships that abuse, abandon, and neglect me again. I want to find a healthy person. We don't even know what that looks like, right? But what we do is we go out and find people just like the people that caused the original trauma. So we go out in adulthood and we start re-traumatizing ourselves in every relationship. And so instead of the trauma getting eased by the relationships, the trauma is actually being exasperated in the relationship. See, it sounds just like an addiction, doesn't it? You know, you think, if I just have this one more drink, everything will be fine. But it actually makes it worse. I remember my sponsor in AA once told me, you know, Rick, there's only one thing that's going to make your situation worse, and that's a drink. Well, if at this stage of the codependent cycle, there's only one thing that's going to make it worse for you, and that's another codependent relationship. Because what you're doing is you're re-traumatizing yourself. So all this is down here, and so the trauma is just growing and growing and growing, and the pain gets worse and worse. That's why so many of us end up here, to cope. Does this all make sense? So at the trunk of the tree is codependence. So this isn't the tree of life, folks. This is the tree of death. This is what our recovery looks like. So you can see that we have to stop the addictive behavior, but we do have to deal with the trauma, and we do have to understand that our relationships are being driven by something that without treatment, without recovery, is only going to make us worse. I can look back over my life, and I can see every relationship was a progressive disaster. And after a while, that's why many of us don't live long. You don't see a lot of old codependents. Just, you know, we either get into addiction and die or have a heart attack or a stroke or... Okay. Hey, look at that. So what's the solution? What's the solution? What I've discovered that the solution is that what was that kid needing in the very beginning? What was the kid missing in their life? Affirmation, nurture, guidance, unconditional love. What they were missing is a loving, healthy adult in their life. That's what they were missing. I knew I was missing that. I wasn't getting it at home. I go to our family Christmas parties, and there was stacks of alcohol and all kinds of things, people fighting and throwing things, and well, I'm not going to get it here, you know. And it just I wondered where I was going to get it. So where does that loving, healthy adult show up in our lives? Where are we going to get it? And what I've discovered in my recovery is that in the final analysis, I'm responsible for reparenting myself. I am the loving, healthy adult in my life that I've always needed. Isn't that beautiful? I remember after a meeting one night, two or three guys and I were standing outside and we were sitting here talking and we were all feeling really good. You know, that's not common for us. And we were feeling really good. We even had joy. And we said, what's going on? Why are we feeling so good? What's all this joy and contentment and feeling good in our own skin? And we realized it's because we had a loving, healthy adult in our life today. And it was us. It was ourselves. So we have to reparent ourselves. We have to show up. Remember, a parent's primary task is to love, nurture, affirm, and guide a child until they can do what? Yeah, it's not meant to be a permanent post. You know, if you're 44 years old and you're still trying to get your mom and dad to do that, something's missing, you know? It's not meant to be a permanent post. It's meant to give you what's needed until you can give it to yourself and find healthy, loving relationships that will affirm that. Relationships in recovery are not intended to give us that. They are intended to affirm that. Things are much happier for me today because I'm giving myself the affirmation, the nurture, and the guidance I need. I'm giving myself the boundaries that are required to have a functional life. I'm giving that to myself. And Elizabeth and I sometimes just marvel at what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. Because we have a healthy, functioning relationship 80% of the time. Yeah. And when we don't, we realize we got to get back to that. Just last night, matter of fact, something happened and she said something that kind of hurt my feelings. And I said, well, okay. You know, and there was a day when that pain, that old historic pain would have been triggered in me. And I'd have been inconsolable for days. Certainly for hours. And I would have lit into her, and she would have gotten defensive, and we just started going round and round and round, and these two little kids would start fighting. Because her little girl and my little boy would start going at each other. I need my needs met. Well, I need my needs met. As if somebody's needs are going to get met, and it isn't going to be both of ours. And so this power struggle begins. where I'm trying to get my needs met and you better do it. And she said, no, you better meet my needs for safety and you're not doing it. And we're going back and forth. It's a good thing we liked each other. We probably wouldn't have stayed married because it was just that kind of a crazy thing on an ongoing basis. So, yeah, those memories start flooding. Wow. So today, last night, I said, you know, when I heard you say this, what I thought about that was this, and what I felt about it was this. And she said, oh, wow, yeah, when I did that, I agree with the data, I did that. And I agree with your thought. In fact, bless her heart, she said, it makes me want to vomit that I did that to you. She said, and I agree with the feeling. I feel pain and shame for doing that. I said, thank you. And we dropped it. And we went home and everything was fine. I mean, that is a miracle. That was a miracle. She said, thank you for talking to me. I said, you're welcome. See, because you know, one of the reasons that happened is because I was there for me. I wasn't so subject to what she was going to do or say that if she didn't love me for a moment, it was going to be disaster for me. If she didn't say something nice to me, I was going to be alone, and I was going to be a little boy playing the hillbilly record again. See? He's still there. But it's not my wife's responsibility to take care of him today. It's whose? Right. It's mine. It's my job. And as long as I'm doing that, we have a shot today of having a wonderful, happy, mutual, respectful, adult relationship. Because as you'll hear me say this afternoon too, it is literally impossible to have a healthy adult relationship if you are not an adult. Right? It's kind of a prerequisite. So I want to spend the rest of our time talking with you and about what it looks like. What is the solution? So this reparenting is huge. And thankfully, the chemical dependency world is beginning to pick up on this, too. They're beginning to realize we can't just treat symptoms. In fact, the director of the chemical dependency program at Bellevue College once told me recently, you know, we're realizing if we don't start talking to recovering people about reparenting, we're going to lose them. Because we're getting them clean and sober, we're sending them out, and they're just, you know, they're still in the same condition. It's like we used to say, what do you get when you sober up a drunken horse thief? A sober horse thief. Yeah, the behavior hasn't changed. You've just taken away the drug. And I'm telling you what, well, I don't want to get into that, but I'm telling you what, you better give me something better than my drug of choice if you're going to keep me free from it. And what's better is learning to be an adult in my life. So these are the 5 points that I want to talk to you about a little bit this morning. This making some sense? Okay, I heard a no. Okay, so the goal of my recovery today, and I believe for every codependent, is to be a functional adult as opposed to an adult child. So what happened between Elizabeth and I last night was a conversation between two functioning adults. It didn't have to go anywhere other than that. And the first thing that I learned about being a functional adult is if you'd have grown up in a healthy home, you'd have learned that self-care was important. You'd have learned by the way you were treated that it's important to take care of yourself. It's important to get enough good food, to get enough rest, to get enough sleep, to have some fun, you know, enjoy your life. So self-care, just basic be nice to yourself stuff. And a child who's grown up in a healthy home, they had to learn that by the way they were treated. You know, they would have been given some new clothes, you know, for school. They'd have been given the right kind of food. They wouldn't have been allowed to eat cookies for dinner every night. You know, there would have been some expression from the primary caregiver that you have value. You are worth being taken care of. When I first got back from treatment, I went to meet with my aftercare specialist, and I said, okay, so what are we going to do? You know, I got PMLE's workbook here, and I got EMDR I heard about, and all of a sudden, I was just raring to go. And she said, we're just going to focus on self-care. And I remember thinking, what? $175 an hour for that? Yeah. I thought I was taking care of it. What I learned over the coming months is I really wasn't. I wasn't eating right. I wasn't getting enough exercise. I wasn't having enough fun. Because what's one of the things that codependents don't know how to do is do what? Yeah, we're serious. Because we're stuck in that teenager in us who's surviving. And everything's serious. Everything's about survival. You know, for me to have fun. And when I try to have fun, I have guilt sometimes. But that's not the case anymore. I play my guitar and do other things. So self-care is job one in our recovery. Self-care is job one. We have the 12 steps and we have these 5 points. If you work both of them, I have found that you can reach functional adulthood. Okay, moderation. Something that we don't know a whole lot about. You know, I have a thought and it goes to catastrophe immediately. I woke up at 2:30 this morning thinking, somebody's going to break in the church. They're going to steal all the stuff that we set up last night. The conference is going to be a disaster, and everybody in the world is going to be mad at me. You know that thinking. Don't look at me like I'm weird. You know that kind of thinking. And so here I am. Here I am at 2:30 in the morning going, staring at the ceiling. Well, who was that? Was that a functional adult talking? No, that was a freaked out little boy or a freaked out teenager getting into survival, trying to, again, anticipate the worst situation in a dysfunctional family, because that's what we have to do to survive. In my home, I had to anticipate the worst and plan for it. So when I got into an adult life, I just continued to do that. Everything's going to be the worst situation. But you know what? So what I did last night is I just said, you know, that's probably not going to happen. It's okay. I took a deep breath. I calmed the little boy down inside of me. I told the teenager, you know what? You can stay home and play your guitar today. I'll go to the conference. I'll handle this one. Let the adult go to the conference, okay? So I exercise moderation in my thinking. Because we swing between extremes. And we see that place in between. We go, hey, what was that? And they say, that's moderation. Oh. Wow. He's never going to call me back. That's, you know. Or you start hearing what ifs. You start hearing what ifs. That's a little boy I found in me, or a little girl in you, if you're a woman. What if? What if this happens? What if that happens? What if this happens? You know, that voice after a while. God bless him. You know, I have come to really love that little guy inside of me and really appreciate the survival skills of that teenager inside of me. I just love those guys today. And they know that. At least they're getting to know that. I don't shame myself. I don't guilt myself into things. I had another thought yesterday thinking, what if you get sick and you can't do your presentation? And you know what I said? I hope you'll be kind to yourself. I hope you'll take care of yourself. That's moderation. Now, boundaries. Now, there is a topic for us, huh? We have one of two things, zero boundaries or walls. But we rarely have porous functional boundaries between us. So when I hear the word boundary, what do you think of? When I say the word boundary, what do you think of? Rules. What was the other some more? A fence? Yeah. Scary? Huh?
Being mean?
Yeah. Yes, I think that's really true. I think those are all great answers. But being mean is really one of our codependent. I can't say no. They won't like me. Or they won't, you know, they'll be mad at me. Or, you know, there's something I need from them that I won't get if I say no to them. So boundaries is all about being able to say no and make it a complete sentence. You can almost tell how far somebody is in their recovery by the way they say no, you know? Yeah, for the first year or so, I'd say, no, but you know, I really would have liked to, but I really can't, but I'd like to. And you know, and by the way, I think sometimes we could do it again sometime maybe. If you could schedule out about a year, maybe we could do it, okay? And people look at me like, what? Or I always start to say with this, I'm sorry, but I can't. You know, just like grinding it out. So the day I don't even say I'm sorry, you know what I say? No, thank you. Or no. whatever, you know, required. But no. And guess who the first person is I have to learn how to say no to in recovery? Me, yeah. I have to say no to that little boy inside of me when he wants to have another packet of cookies for breakfast. Or when he wants to wake me up at 2:30 in the morning and tell me about the latest catastrophe he's fearing. I have to learn how to say no to the anxiety. No to some of the things that would drive my life otherwise. Okay, so boundaries are very, very important. And boundaries are all about self-containment. Primarily about self-containment. Not letting everything somebody says, think, or does affect my life. A friend of mine were talking just recently. He said, what is the goal in boundaries? And we said, to be able to say, huh. And leave it at that. Well, I think that presentation this morning really stunk, Rick. Huh. You know, I say to myself, well, that's interesting information. Thank you. You know, whatever, you know. Or somebody says, oh, I think you just walk on water, Rick. You just did such a good deal. Oh, man, I tell you. Because you know what? I can't afford to get caught up in either one of those, right? Because the minute I start taking your approval in again, I'm an approval addict. So I start thinking, oh, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, baby, keep it coming, you know, yeah. Yeah, I am great, aren't I? Yeah, and I am because you say I am, yeah. So I have to learn how to say, huh, or, well, that's interesting, and leave it at that. That's a boundary. That's an external boundary. Pia Mele calls this the Pia Chai, I think it is. You do this. You have external boundaries. You have internal boundaries. And when those are in place, you're a pretty functional human being. When I was in treatment, I was told there's virtually no codependent problem that cannot be resolved with good boundaries. So it's really the linchpin upon which we function. And then reality. When I say reality, I'm talking about simply living in the now, being present in your own life. Not swinging, not getting into the guilt of the past or the fear of the future. If only if I had, or what if I didn't, or what if. And I'm living in anywhere but now. And you can tell a codependent when you're talking to them because they're not there. They're looking over your shoulder. They're thinking and looking at their watch or checking their phone. And they're kind of smiling at you because they don't want to get you mad at them, you know. And but they're really just not present. Because they're not present with themselves. They don't know how to make good eye contact. And so in recovery, we need to stay present and stay in reality. Reality also means that a functional adult can discern a situation and not catastrophize it, like I mentioned earlier, or even not minimize it. If something's going on that's serious, a functional adult can recognize it and take action. That's what's so crazy about us and untreated codependents. We tend to minimize the really serious things and worry about the trivial nonsense. No, if people are laughing, I know that laugh. I know, because we experience it. So reality is simply living in the now and not living in the past, being present to yourself. Stay present, which is beautiful. And so spirituality, when I mean spirituality, I'm talking about being connected, okay? We tend to do religiosity really well, because that's what teenagers would like to do. They like to get into black and white. Adapted teenager likes to get in. I want to know the truth. And I want to eliminate everybody else who's not in the truth. So you want to kind of get into a religious situation. Sometimes we kind of circle the wagons and it's us against them. I know things that you don't know. And you know, I can quote the Bible, but I don't know what it means type stuff. You know, I can talk about love, but I don't know how to give it. But doggone it, I believe in it. But spirituality is about connectedness. Authentic spirituality is about feeling connected to a power greater than yourself, God as you understand God, to yourself and the people around you. As you were all coming in today, I just felt warmth in my heart. And you know why? Because I'm allowing myself to connect with you. What a beautiful thing. I mean, I was able today when you were coming in, I greeted some of you and I was able to make eye contact. I saw Scott come down from Bellingham and Rickey, and it was just I felt connected. And isn't that what I've always wanted? And guess what? I didn't have to control you to get it. I didn't have to manipulate you to get it. I didn't have to demand that you give it to me or else. I didn't have to follow you around like a puppy dog if you gave it to me. I have a friend. I remember saying that as a kid. Because I went to 6 different grade schools, 2 different junior highs, and 2 different high schools. Now, if that's not a recipe for being screwed up, I don't know what is. I was a chronically new kid in the class. And guess what? We never left town. I was like, my dad would say, oh, it's time to move again. I said, why? I just got these 2 friends. Well, I don't know. I'm just going to do it. Okay, so we'd move. And then I'd be the... So I remember I made a couple of friends. I was probably in my 3rd or 4th grade. And I remember running home. I saw my dad pulling the driveway, and I ran home, and I ran up to him. I said, I have friends. You know, he kind of grumped and walked by. But man, I tell you, it was great. And I have that today with people around me. Not everybody's my friend. Not everybody wants to be my friend. But I have an ability to connect with you, look you in the eye, and not... as you'll hear me say this afternoon, not I it you, but I thou you. You're not a thing. See, this is the thing, and I'm learning in my spirituality and recovery, is that you are a human being. You have a name. You have value. You have worth. You're not a registrant. One of the registrants showed up today and had forgotten to pay their fee. You know, that's I it. You're not a thing. You're a person. So when we connect, it's an I-thou relationship. So unconditional self-acceptance is the other part of my spirituality. It's very important. Unconditional self-acceptance. And I expand that to include unconditional acceptance of others as well. You know, that is the contrary to every codependent on the planet, right? Because I spent my whole life trying to control and manipulate you to get my needs met. So for me to unconditionally accept you today, and maybe even say, huh, to you from time to time, it means that I'm not trying to make you into something I think you should be in order to, so I can have my needs met. You see how marriage just doesn't work in a codependent world? So this afternoon, we'll talk about some of this some more. I'll be talking about love addiction and love avoidance. And what I want to talk about then is I'm going to talk about how this works out in relationships. We'll talk a little bit more about the bonding that didn't happen and why that didn't happen. We'll talk about the abandonment that creates a love addict and the enmeshment that creates a love avoidant and how they find each other. As insane as that is. So, what's that? Love addiction and love avoidance. Yeah, we're going to be talking about that this afternoon. So we talk about how abandonment in childhood, emotional abandonment especially, creates a love addict. And how enmeshment with a parent or a primary caregiver creates a love avoidant. Does that sound interesting? It's really the second part of this talk today. So now I want to take the next 5 or 10 minutes and just answer any questions you might have. I'm not an authority, but I live this stuff, baby. So I can tell you about what I would do and what I've done and what I've read and learned about codependence. So what is codependence? What did we learn this morning? What is codependence? Drama? Unmet needs, yeah, that's good. Yeah, yeah. An unhealthy relationship with yourself. Ah! Thank you, Patty. Good job. An unhealthy relationship with myself. And guess where I learned? How did I get there? I learned that, right? That's what I learned about myself. It breaks my heart to think that I was treated in such a way that I learned not to like myself. So that I had to go around making you like me. And guess what? It is impossible for you to love me enough to make up for my not doing it myself. It is impossible. It's an endless pit. Remember that? You hear about that guy recently, the sinkhole opened up in his house, and he went down into the pit, and they never found him again. And they looked for him. They couldn't find him. That's how deep that pit was. That's like being in a relationship with a codependent. It's just a deep pit. You cannot give them enough. Does an alcoholic ever have enough alcohol? Does a drug addict ever have enough drugs? Does a codependent ever have enough approval and love? No. And the reason it isn't is because I'm not giving it to myself. If I'm giving, the reason Elizabeth was able to live through it last night is because I was there for me. I was loving myself. I'm not so dependent upon her loving me that I'm going to die if she doesn't. Because I'm telling you this, if my life, the quality of my life is dependent upon how you treat me, you can bet I'm going to control you. I have to. I said, if the quality of my life, if my well-being is dependent upon you loving me and approving of me, then you can bet your sweet bippy that I'm going to control you. Wouldn't you? Of course you would, because your life depends on it. At least that's what the little kid inside of you thinks. Your life depends on me, and so I'm sorry. It's like the movie Misery. I'm about to break your legs. I can't let you leave. And it's only doing it because I love you. L-U-V. There's no L-O-V-E there. So any other thoughts? What is codependence? Yeah. No. You know, sometimes I have to speak to myself like you speak to an unruly child. No. Therapist once told me, sometimes you have to have rebar, Rick. No. But you always have to be loving. And sometimes you just have to say, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah. Where does the self-love come from?
Where does the self-love come from? That's a great point. My self-love, my ability to love myself is primarily, these are my guidelines. I know if I'm living those. I was in a seminar one time, for instance, in PML, and he said, if you're not in moderation, you're not in recovery. Okay? So if you're not in moderation, you're not loving yourself. If you're forcing yourself to go to extremes all the time, you're not loving yourself, right? If you're not taking care of yourself, you're not eating good food and getting enough rest and having some fun, then you're not loving yourself. So, but where it also comes for me is my relationship with my higher power. Because as I get, as my conscious contact with my God, as I understand God, increases, and I get to know that presence more and more in my heart and feel the love and feel the ability to trust my higher power, I learned that I can do that for myself, too. I can learn to trust myself. I can feel loved. Any other questions, thoughts? Yeah.
How does a person stop the catastrophizing, or is that just kind of a natural result of getting healthier?
So, yeah, the question is, how do you stop the catastrophizing? Well, the first thing to do is recognize it as a catastrophe. That's the adult's job, because a child has a great imagination. I even had a therapist tell me one time, boy, Ricky's got a great imagination. And he does. You know, I can take anything to any extreme. But yeah, so you have to recognize it as catastrophizing, first of all, and then recognizing where it's coming from. Who's doing the talking here? One of the beautiful things in my life, I'm getting to know the different sense of who's really telling me what here, the thinking process. What if? Or, I know, we'll just kill it. That's a teenager, you know. That'll solve it. You know, he was a tough guy at times. Yeah.
So, catastrophizing and self-sabotage are not the same.
Well, for me they are. Catastrophizing and self-sabotage. If I'm catastrophizing, I'm usually going to self-sabotage.
Right,
for instance... I'm sure there are some distinction. Yeah. So the question is catastrophe and self-sabotaging, are they the same or they're different? And I say yes. They're different and they're
specific. It's to yourself.
Yeah. 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 For instance, if I was catastrophizing last night about what was going to happen at the conference, and I got myself sick about it, you know, and then I couldn't come to the conference, you know, or came down here and made a fool out of myself and got arrested, that would be self-sabotaging. Yeah, so, yeah. Let's go here. Yeah. Get well. I think the most loving thing I can do for my 5 kids and 7 grandkids today is work my recovery program. You know, don't tell your kids you love them and then not go to a meeting ever. Don't tell your kids you love them, then treat yourself like garbage. Because they're going to pick up on that. There's an inconsistency there. And they'll pick up on that because your kids will want to treat themselves like they see you treating yourself. So if you really want to love your kids, you want to feel it, then have them, then love yourself. Yeah.
And if they're already adults?
If they're already adults, then, you know, you make amends. Yeah. Yeah, my kids are in total recovery from my parenting, you know. They're all adults now, and they all have their own lives. But you know what we do have today is we have an adult relationship. So I don't try to control them. I don't try to manipulate them. I let them know I love them, and I give them the right to fail. One of my kids moved to Virginia recently, and I thought to myself one day, "Why are you doing that?" And then he called me yesterday. He goes, "I don't know why I did this, Dad. I think I want to come back." I said, "Sound like you want to come back. I'd love to see you." But I learned not to say, "Why in the hell are you moving to Virginia, boy?" And then, because he'd have stayed there for 20 years then, probably. or when he called me yesterday and said, "Well, I told you so." That was the dumbest thing he could have ever done. But he knew he could trust me, and he called me and said, "Dad, I think I made a mistake." And I said, "You know what? A functional family, mistakes are okay. God allows U-turns, and so do we." Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, how do you get into recovery and recover from codependence when you're with a person or you're married to a person, you're in a relationship with a person who isn't? I would just say you have to let go and take care of yourself. And you have to quit jumping through hoops. You have to quit playing the game. And you'll learn, this afternoon, if you're in that session, you'll learn some more about that. So does that help? Yeah. Becky? Yeah.
Uh-huh. But I think if you're not
Did you hear what Becky just said? That's powerful. Thank you very much for that. If you're not engaged in any of these five bullet points, then you're probably self-sabotaging. And you know when we know we self-sabotaged? It's hindsight. I never know I'm doing it while I'm doing it. If I knew I was doing it, I wouldn't do it, right?